Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 675, July 2023.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell. And you know, this summer has been our Indiana summer, where we have looked back on the Indiana Jones movies that we had not previously covered. And it was all leading to this, I suppose. This year's, 2023's, Indiana Jones movie? It's true. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, directed by James Mangold, stepping in for Steven Spielberg. So this is not an adjunct to the summer of Spielberg, I suppose. It's its own thing. Indiana Jones 5, you thought that the Crystal Skull was a late sequel, but guess what? There's a later sequel. We saw this, and we're going to talk about it. And if you don't want to be spoiled about some of the things that happen, and there's some wild things that happen in this movie, then you should not listen any further, unless you just enjoy being spoiled, in which case, continue. I am joined by these wonderful people to talk about younger and then older Indiana Jones and that Destiny Dial. John McCoy is here. Hi, John.
Hi, Eureka. I'm not actually quoting the movie. I'm saying hi to my hometown of Eureka, Illinois. Go Hornets!
fantastic. Shout out to Eureka, California. I'm not from there, though. Deb Standish is also here. Hello.
Hey, listen, can we find out what that filter they use to make Indiana Jones look younger? Because I just need that around me all the time now.
It's filter is not probably the word for it, but
we live in a TikTok world,
like a Lucille Ball kind of thing where they put a burlap sack in front of the camera and she looks all fuzzy.
Yes. Lots of Vaseline on the camera.
Yeah, exactly. Like every Star Trek episode. Annette Wierstra is also here. Hi, Annette.
Hey, I'm just here to steal Helena's outfits. Thanks.
All right. Very nice. And Stephen Schimpansky is here. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. I'll be the first to say it's not the years, it's the mileage. Mm. There we go. There's no context to it, but I just wanted to say it first.
Maybe it is the years and the mileage. And joining Stephen from their podcast studio, just popping in as our last contestant, panelist, is Erica Ensign. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Annette kind of stole my line because Deb wants the quote unquote filter that Harrison Ford had. I want the upcycled fabrics by Stella McCartney. That's what I'm here for.
Tough call.
Indiana Jones, we talked about it this summer. You know, I have watched all of these movies this summer. I came to the opinion that Crystal Skull is sort of unjustly maligned, and although it's not great, it's not terrible either. And I still really don't like Temple of Doom. but what I feel like the lesson that I learned more than anything else is Indiana Jones, from this vantage point in 2023, you need to look at it for what it is, which is a silly, fun adventure movie series that's modeled after adventure serials. And that's what Lucas and Spielberg always meant it to kind of be, and not treat it as sacred ground. I do think Raiders of the Lost Ark is a legitimately great movie, but like the series, it's just meant to be fun adventure. And that is why I understood my initial reaction to the Crystal Skull and was able to sort of get over it, seeing it again many years later. And so going into Dial of Destiny, I had that same thought, which is, you know what? I like Indiana Jones. Those movies are fun. Let's see what it is. And I didn't try to make it like, oh boy, I hope they stick the landing. Everything since 1981 has been leading up to this. And instead sort of made it, what will be the MacGuffin this time? And what will be the set pieces this time? And where do we find Indiana Jones? And as a result, I came out of it feeling that it was a fun movie, and like, which was a strange thing. It's like, can you render your verdict on this series that's meant so much to you over the years? And I was like, you know what? I'm not going to play that game. I'm just going to say, I thought it was a fun movie, not a perfect movie, but a fun movie. But like, it's weird, right? Like, this is this series that has gone on for a long time, and now we've got an old man having adventures.
A young man, and
a young man who sort of moves like an old man, but is a young man. It's just a peculiar thing to be here. I don't know if anybody has any thoughts about just like having come to this, which is a fifth Indiana Jones movie in 2023.
Yeah, it feels like the most 2023 Indiana Jones there could possibly be. I feel like in 2023, after the last 3 years, like everything is a little different than it was a few years back. And, you know, not necessarily in a bad way, but just a little bit off. Like this is an Indiana Jones movie, but it's not directed by Steven Spielberg, although it really felt like it was. It's an Indiana Jones film, but Harrison Ford's older. Oh, wait, but then Harrison Ford's younger, sort of. And we have a new character. Oh, it's a woman. Whoa, she gets real lines. Oh my God, she gets funny lines. It was just like there were a lot of things that were very Indiana Jonesy, but a little bit different, a little bit canted from sort of what I was not necessarily expecting, but what happened in the previous movies. I agree with you, Jason. As I said on our episode about Crystal Skull, I purposely did not rewatch the other movies. I wanted to just go into that as cold as possible. And I kind of did the same thing here. I was like, I'm not gonna do my homework before I go see this movie. I am going to live with the delightful memories that I have of those other movies, not counting Temple of Doom, and go into this movie and see if I enjoy it. And I did. It was a fun time at the movie theater. You know, some of the chase scenes were a little too long, and that's what I felt about the other movies too. So, So yeah, it's all of a piece to me. I think it was a good time.
See, I did the exact opposite. I did do my homework. So like the day before we went to see this, we watched all four movies. Like I was sick as a dog. So like it was a good thing to do as I was recovering. And my son and I watched all four movies. And I thought, I'd never seen Crystal Skull. Like this is in my mind, I'd never seen Crystal Skull. But as I was watching Crystal Skull, I'm like, wait a second, I remember this part. And then I remembered that we had watched it until Indiana climbed into the lead-lined refrigerator and went flying through the air. And at that point, because I had not done my homework previously, I said, this is ridiculous. I cannot watch this. This is just too ridiculous. But after watching all of those movies in a row, like it is just ridiculous fun, period. Like that is not out there. That is right there. That's right in there. So going into, I actually found Dial of Destiny to have a little bit more gravitas than those previous movies, which I was not expecting. I was expecting to go in to have more dumb fun, which there was. I mean, there's some really ridiculous bits in this movie, but there was a little bit more weightiness than I was expecting. But as far as like, you know, a fun summer popcorn movie, like absolutely, like went in, no expectations, just was there for the ride. And I really liked it. Agree with you, Erica, but I agree about that with every chase scene. So it was good time.
Good time.
I feel like, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull probably prepared me for this more than anything because we watched it for The Incomparable and I was expecting to hate it because we've just sort of like we've kind of Berenstain Bears Mandela affected this movie into our heads where obviously that's the worst one. We don't even acknowledge its existence. And then like an hour into the movie, I turned to Erica and says, this movie is fun. What was wrong with us for 15 years? And so because I enjoyed that one so much, I felt like, well, you know what? Dial of Destiny can do no wrong. I'm going to go in, and if anything seems outlandish, I'm just going to remember that in the very first Indiana Jones movie, a bunch of magical ghosts come out of an ark and melt Nazis.
Like crayons.
Like crayons. And so if that movie can do that, and we hold that with such reverence, this movie, I don't know what's going to come at me. It can do anything, and I'm here for it. And so when the things happen at the end of the film, I go, yep, I'm on board. It might be the most outlandish we get in the Indiana Jones series, but I can see it.
I mean, trans-dimensional aliens fly off in their flying saucer in a previous episode, so maybe not.
What the heck, man? Just go with it.
John, what do you think?
I had two thoughts. One was I was more aware watching this movie than I ever am with any other Indiana Jones movies about all the stuff that came together to make this movie. I mean, COVID, Shia LaBeouf being discontinued. You know, all, you can see there's like this shows the around the edges the process of it being made. But on the other hand, I also agree. I think that the Indiana Jones movies are at heart very silly, and this was a very silly movie, and I enjoyed that. One thing that I thought of, though, because this film is set in 1969, and so it's kind of towards the end of Mad Men, I was thinking that the first movies were set in the 1930s, and they took their cue from serials from the 30s. I was wondering, why couldn't they have like done like something like Robert Altman for this film? You know, they could have like set this in like squarely in the 60s. But I'm probably the only person who thinks that.
It's funny. They actually, if you do the math and timed it out, this movie probably should have been set in the 70s. And they seemed to decide they wanted it still to hang on in the 60s because they preferred that kind of vibe that, to being like Indiana Jones and the disco ball of destiny, right? They didn't really want that, so they went with this. But I thought about
now
the same
I
thing.
I want that, Jason. So, gosh
well,
darn it.
Well, then movie I six. Movie six, too. You can direct it. I'll write the screenplay. Yeah, you direct it. Move over, James Mangold. Yeah, so they made a decision, but I had that thought too, which is, they always said that the alien element in Crystal Skull was sort of like a tip of the hat to the 50s because they were in the 50s then. But now we're in the late 60s and it's not, you know, it's not Robert Altman. It's not Blow Up, nor is it Star Trek or I don't know, something else from that era. But yeah, they sort of left. They wanted to do what people think of for Indiana Jones, which is silly fun.
Indiana Jones is not like the Alien series, you know, it's not like you're getting a different genre every time. You're right. Getting the same genre every time, and it does what it says on the tin.
Exactly. Annette, do you have any initial thoughts about how we ended up here?
Yes, I ended up here because I keep watching movies with you, Jason.
Okay,
and
thank
doing
you.
Episodes about it. Okay. And making you mad sometimes and being really excited that everyone kind of came around on Crystal Skull because I always kind of liked it and was just, well, it's not that, like, it's fine. It's all just like all of the rest of the movies. So I just was prepared to love this because I just love all the Indiana Jones movies and I'm going to take it whatever I can get. And there was something really magical about sitting in the seat in the theater again and watching a new movie. And I was just so happy. And
it's because you were sitting next to me, right?
Aww. It's true. It was. And the whole time I kept going to Eric, I was like, look at that outfit.
It was a good thing we were sitting next to each other and not separated really by one of our spouses.
And wasn't it nice watching like a popcorn summer movie that wasn't a Marvel movie?
Yes.
It's different.
Yes. Yeah. Feels like, yes. It was a great experience.
So speaking of Marvel, although not quite the same Marvel, but James Mangold, one of his movies is Logan, which is a movie that I liked a lot and is a very kind of dark take on the end of life of various superheroes. And I thought it was really good. And when somebody mentioned earlier that there is a little bit of a darker undertone to some of this, I feel like compared to Logan, it certainly is not. And yet I do think that James Mangold is trying to put some weight on this, trying to put some weight on Indiana Jones' age and the fact that he feels isolated and he's, you know, he's retiring from the university and he's not really appreciated anymore. And he's sort of at loose ends and what has become of my life. And that is the part that reminded me a little bit, like he's taking a little bit of the seasoning from something like Logan and putting it in here while not forgetting that it's an Indiana Jones movie and it should feel like one. And in fact, it does feel like one. But what I wanted to start with in our conversation is the first half hour of the movie, which is literally like from another Indiana Jones movie. And this is the set in the 40s. It's during World War II. Nazis are after a thing. There's a train. There's action and adventure. And and Toby Jones is in it. It's just Toby Jones. There he is. And Indiana Jones looks as he looked in those early Indiana Jones movies using the magic of de-aging technology. And I loved this section for two reasons. One is because I never expected to see, I'm actually getting a little emotional saying this, never actually expected to see an Indiana Jones movie from the 80s again, right? The 80s are over. And yet it was like half an hour of Indiana Jones 2.5, 3.5, something like that. And then two, I'm happy everybody can have their own opinions out there in the world about VFX. And there are a lot of people who are very skeptical of de-aging stuff. I thought this was the best de-aging technology I've ever seen. And I thought they were actually sort of like doing donuts at times where they're like, yeah, we can have like a bright light that's on part of his face and not the other part. And it moves. And they're like, we can do that. We can do anything now. But so I was very impressed with the technology. But more than that, I loved that the movie starts with a solid, 20-30 minutes saying, here's why you're here. Is this kind of movie, right? This is the Indiana Jones you know. This is the one that you've always loved. We're going to give you that before we do the smash cut to a 75-year-old shirtless Indiana Jones living in a, pouring whiskey into his coffee cup in New York City. I loved that they went for it with this first segment. And yes, it sets up the plot. Even if it didn't set up the plot, I wouldn't care. But it does set up the plot because we get Mads Mikkelsen and he's a Nazi who's obsessed with a thing. And you know how that's going to go, right? Because it's Indiana Jones.
It's always a thing. It's funny because I watched this all with my son who was visiting us for the month. And during Crystal Skull, he's like, man, I really wish that we like had a movie or books or something that had all of Indiana Jones's adventures during World War II, because they talk about his service record in Crystal Skull. And like, there it was. It was like a gift, like right there on the screen.
He's working for the OSS or whatever in during the war, right? Because otherwise we saw him before the war. With the rise of the Nazis in Last Crusade and in Raiders of the Lost Ark, but then it's cited that he worked for the government during the war, but we never see it. And so here we are, we get to see it. And he's just also, by the way, is he doing government stuff? No, he's doing Indiana Jones stuff. That's what he does. Like if you're the government, you're not like
happens to kind of help the government.
Right. Well, the government, obviously very smart, is just saying, well, we didn't hire you to do that. We hired you to do the thing you do just for us. OK. And he's like, sure, whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, I keep forgetting that this part of the movie even happened.
Really?
Yeah, when somebody says, oh, how did you like the movie? I am thinking of old Indy and, and just all of his sadness and adventures and grumpiness. And I like the only reason that I'm even remembering this part is because you keep bringing it up. I had already forgotten when you said, Jason, like the first half hour of the movie, I was like, I genuinely thought that that was the part where he was yelling at his loud rock and roll neighbors and running around. It's like, oh, right, that other thing happened, which I'm not saying that that means it shouldn't be there. I'm just saying that that means it didn't really stick out for me. I am glad that it exists for all of those reasons that you said, Jason, but I think it just didn't make nearly as much of an impact on me because I was more excited about the difference.
I think your brain just absorbs it and files it into the catalog of Indiana Jones history, which is sort of what they're trying to do there. By the way, I love the Beatles, but they were playing that music way too loud. That's my old man comment of the day.
I'm glad, actually, about the Beatles, I'm glad if they actually played a song from 1968 in 1969, because so many movies will default to playing a song that's just that week is out. Yeah. And no one listens to brand new music, especially back in the 60s. So I appreciated that they played Magical Mystery Tour and not something from, I don't know, Hey Jude or something even from later.
Yeah.
I thought that was attention to detail, or maybe that's just the rights to the song they could get from the Beatles. I don't know.
Let's go with attention to detail.
Yeah, exactly.
The other thing about that early segment is that the early segment is setting up, like, we get Toby Jones. Toby Jones, I love to see him, although I did have that moment, and Lauren, who watched it with me, we were walking out, and she was like, I had that moment where I saw Toby Jones in World War II with the Nazis, and I thought, oh no, he's bad. And she had to have that moment of like, no, that's Captain America. This is a different movie. He's good in this one. He's not doing a German accent in this one. He's doing his British accent. But he's necessary because he is also the father of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who we see later. And so that is a connection. And then there is Mads Mikkelsen, who is obsessed with the Antikythera mechanism, which is the driving force and the MacGuffin of the plot. So it is relevant in that way. But like I enjoy that we get shenanigans in a castle, shenanigans on a train. Like all of that is just very Indiana Jones. And I thought it was very well done. Let's take a break from the podcast just for a minute. Let me tell you about our sponsor. This episode of The Incomparable is being brought to you by Factor. Now we're in the thick of summer. You may be looking for wholesome, convenient meals to support sunny, active days. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal kit, and it can help you fuel up fast with flavorful and nutritious ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. You'll save time, eat well, and stay on track at reaching your goals. I have tried these Factor meals, and let me tell you, I was really impressed by the quality of the meals, especially not just all the ingredients, but like the meat. I had chicken dinners that were like, I don't know, I've gotten some bad box meats before, let's just put it that way, and these were so good. Tender white meat, chicken breast, very high quality ingredients. Couldn't really say enough nice things about them. And I'll tell you, working at home by myself, lunches are hard. And also my wife works late on one night a week. And it's like dinner for one. What's that going to be? So convenient in a couple of minutes to get a full dinner from Factor, and tasty too. Skip that extra trip to the grocery store. These are fresh, never frozen meals, and they are ready in just 2 minutes. More than 34 different weekly restaurant quality options like bruschetta shrimp risotto, green goddess chicken, or grilled steakhouse filet mignon. That's right. Keep your energy up with lunch to go as well. Factor's effortless wholesome meals like grain bowls and salad toppers, no microwave required at all. Factor offers options to fit a variety of lifestyles, including keto, calorie smart, vegan and veggie, and protein plus. Then select from more than 45 different add-ons, including breakfast items like apple cinnamon pancakes, bacon and cheddar egg bites, and smoothies. And you can rest assured you're making a sustainable choice, because Factor offsets 100% of the delivery emissions to your door, along with sourcing renewable energy and featuring sustainably sourced seafood. Go to factormeals.com/snell50 and use the code SNELL50 to get 50% off your first box. That's code SNELL50, my last name, and 50 at factormeals.com/snell50, SNELL50, to get 50% off your first box. Thank you to Factor for supporting The Incomparable.
I had two things I wanted to say about the de-aging. One was, I was right on board for Harrison Ford's de-aging, but Mads Mikkelsen looks shiny and taut, like he's wearing a Mads Mikkelsen mask or something like that. I don't know why he didn't get the same high-end treatment that Harrison Ford did.
Maybe he did. Maybe his face is just like impossible to
know. Yeah. I think they thought they could get away with like, Mads, play young. We'll put some makeup on you and, you know, just pretend to be young. Because I had a moment, John, where I thought, surely this plot involves Mads Mikkelsen getting some sort of device that prevents him from aging, right? Because it can't be. And it's like, no, we're just going to make him sort of shiny at the beginning and not at the end. I'm like, okay, all right.
And the other thing I would say is, it probably should swing around to this when we're getting to the end of this discussion and sort of talking about themes of the movies. I think there's something a little odd about starting this particular movie with something that is so self-consciously a throwback. And I'll explain myself later, because I don't want to get too deep into themes right now. But at the time, I was enjoying it, but I was also thinking, huh.
I think I will consider that you setting a ticking clock prominently in a location where we can all hear it ticking, because I had that moment where I was like, I see what you're doing, James Mangold. It's not that subtle, but it's fine. It's Indiana Jones. It's fine. I get it. I get it. The passage of time. I see what you're doing there.
I think a way you could have started it without that entire sequence to perhaps have a mound of dirty dishes shaped like the Paramount logo or something.
Oh, man.
And then the Paramount logo dissolved to that. And then it's just, it starts with the Indiana Jones asleep in his chair. And that's the beginning of your movie. And you cut off 20 minutes off the top.
Surely the way that it should have opened, and I'm not sure if it does actually open this way, but what it should be is you start on a mountain and then you pan down to a castle, right?
Yeah.
Because you're going from Paramount to Disney. So that's how you should. That's how you should.
Oh, right, but we never did. Lucasfilm got in the way. I tell you, that was actually one of the more jarring things, that we never got the Paramount logo dissolve into it. That I could tell that we were kind of in new territory now. You know, it took me what, three films to get over Star Wars not having the 20th Century Fox fanfare at the top. So I guess I'll just have
to
live with this.
Intellectual property, it happens. So in the 60s, Indiana Jones, by the way, I love the fact, and this is something throughout these movies, the ultimate indignity is when somebody calls him Mr. Jones. I love it when his neighbors are like, oh, Mr. Jones, what's wrong? And they're like, he's just the cranky old man who lives upstairs. But we find out.
I feel that whenever I get somebody calling me ma'am, same thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I didn't go to archaeological school for 8 years to be called Mr. Jones. So he is retiring from a teaching job. We get a college teaching scene. It is so sad. If you remember, especially that first scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they are absolutely enraptured, and the one woman has "love you" written on her eyelids, and then there's the guy who gives him the apple and all of that. And here, he's giving his presentation. Nobody seems to be paying attention to him. It's just very sad. This whole thing, like, he's lonely. He's got divorce papers from Marion. And it's just, again, and I like that they chose to do this. So full credit to James Mangold and the other writers of this. You know, it's way more interesting to come to our hero and find that they've had a terrible time and things are really messed up for them, because it gives them some place to go. But I think that there is a fear that you are treading on sacred territory when you do something like this. I love that they did this, because it is sad, but also it gives Indiana Jones a final story to tell, and lets him go somewhere. And it all starts where, of course, crashing his class is Helena Shaw, who is Toby Jones's daughter, and she wants to know more about this dial of destiny that her father was obsessed with, and that kicks us down the path of there's a Nazi who is basically Werner von Braun. he's been hired, and this is, I mean, it's not fair to Werner von Braun. That's why it's a different name. But the fact is, the U.S. space program hired a lot of people who were on the German rocket program. And they were, you know, they were all, did they like Hitler? I don't know. I mean, they went along with him because they had to, or because they wanted to. Who knows? But like, that complexity does really exist in the space program. So to have Mads Mikkelsen basically be that guy and only lightly hidden from being just still a Nazi, and his thugs who are you know, learning how to speak German because they're gonna they have a plan to bring back the Third Reich. They're after the same thing that Helena is after, which of course Indiana Jones has. Of course he does. And that leads us on our adventure, where we get ultimately a chase. All the people in his college department are horribly murdered, and there is a moment where he is aghast at that, which is one of a few moments in here where ultra violence of action movies is actually commented on, which is pretty rare. But it leads to it's very The Fugitive, where he's hiding out in a parade, and then he's running. He's got a horse that he's riding around and down into the subway and all that. And this is our first big action set piece of the movie, is this part in here. And that begins the tale of the Dial of Destiny.
You know, the horse running down those stairs, that was the one thing in the film I just couldn't swallow. I could take all the other craziness, including the end of the movie. But, you know, I know too much about horses and the way their hooves work. And you that horse would have tripped forward, broken every bone in its body.
That's fair. I accepted it going down the stairs, but I did not accept it jumping slightly diagonally to miss a onrushing train. I thought, no, horses are not precision instruments that you can steer quite like that.
I loved it.
But it was fun.
Right.
Oh, it was fun.
I thought it was such a good start to put him back on a horse because, you know, obviously he is an older man now and, you know, running around is not as easy for him to do. As soon as they got him back up on that horse, I was just, I don't know. I felt like it was like, yes, you're home, Indy, even though he's not really home until later.
Yeah, I like that. Just going back to how, like, you know, he's old and he's, you know, in a pretty bad state. That's both a credit to Harrison Ford, who I think wanted to put him there. Like, you know, I love how I think there's an anecdote on set where like a stunt man was doing a stunt and Harrison Ford pulled him aside and says, no, you look like you're 40 doing a stunt for me. I'm 80. I should look like I'm struggling to crawl off this horse or something like that. Like, you know, he owns the age that he is.
Right.
What I like about the fact that he's set in the 60s is that, you know, obviously he existed in the real world in the previous four films, but I feel like we're so attuned to 60s nostalgia that this felt for the first time that Indiana Jones actually existed in our world, and he's just sitting in front of a TV, which, you know, a lot of us have done that, and you know, he's living in this very squalid apartment right now, and it just felt for the first time that Indiana Jones was a real person existing in these and not just some sort of you know, fantasy hero for the first time. And I immediately connected with Indy right off the bat because of that.
And watching the moon landing, you know, and things about astronauts on TV is sort of weird. Of like, I've never really thought about Indiana Jones right this late, right? Essentially in 1969. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not how we think of him at all.
You know, you talk about his aging, and that's part of the gravitas that I had talked about that caught me by surprise, because as you said, in not in Temple of Doom, but in Raiders and in Last Crusade and even in Crystal Skull, we get classroom scenes.
Right.
And he is, you know, he's very respected. The respect, you know, it goes from mad adoration to just respect as he gets older. But to have that scene is just heartbreaking, but it's so realistic to the invisibility of aging.
Yeah.
You know, people that have lived incredible lives and you just, it's just not taken into consideration. You just see what's in front of you, not the past history. But there's also a scene in the, I guess they're in the stacks after all of his colleagues have been murdered. And he's grabbed by the goons and he like hauls off to like punch this guy. Like, this is classic Indy. And he just can't do it. Like, he's old now. He just cannot do that. So I think seeing that physical manifestation of age, and also just having watched the whole season of Shrinking on Apple TV, where like grumpy Harrison Ford is like my favorite Ford ever. You know, it felt so realistic. And I have so much respect for both the actor and the filmmakers for not glossing over that, for not making him, like you said, I mean, having a stunt double act like he's 40. He is not. He is an elderly man. And that is shown so often in the beginning. I think we lose that towards the end, but it's in the beginning, it's set up very, very nicely.
Yeah, the movie forgets about it. Or at least tries to forget about it as much as it can, because it really does want to have exciting action set pieces. And so you can't hang on to that. Although I was very impressed. Like I mentioned this before on this podcast, I think talking about Indiana Jones, even that we had a moment when Scott McNulty and I were doing the Vulcan Hello and we were doing Picard season two, and they tried to do like a chase scene where a bunch of machine gun toting mercenaries are trying to chase Jean-Luc Picard through a haunted house, essentially. And it's really like they're running and they've got guns and stuff. And then an old man slowly walks and it's like, no, you can't, you can't do it that way. And this movie doesn't try to, this movie lets Harrison Ford, who I think is, you know, can do more than Patrick Stewart maybe, but like also it wants you to know that he's old and that he can't do what he used to do, but only a little bit, right? And then it also wants you to have a good time and say, sure, why not have him go down to the bottom of the ocean or, you know, whatever he needs to do. But I appreciate the nods to the fact that he can't do it like he used to, even if he can do more of it later than he can in those first scenes. He gets better at punching people.
He's
later.
Warming up at the beginning. Like he's just loosening up the old muscles.
Some of that adventure magic. Yeah.
You know, Marion says at the end, like, are you back?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, he's back, baby.
Turns out I'm much younger when I'm punching Nazis.
<That's right>.
Isn't that true of all of us?
It's true. It keeps you young.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
I want to go back to the divorce papers because I didn't know what was going to happen with Marion. And so then my stomach sank, but also like, okay, don't panic.
She said a bad word out loud. You did.
Maybe. But like, because like that one of the reasons why I really liked Crystal Skull is because it left us in like the happy ever after. And so it was like, you better not mess this up. And I care deeply about this relationship and I'm going to give you some latitude because I'm very excited to be here. But I was like, oh, you're on thin ice right from the beginning. Yes. So I'm not, we can save my thoughts, more thoughts till later, but, and then it dives into the action and stuff. And I did appreciate the moment when, you know, Mr. This Belongs in a Museum kicks over stacks and stacks and stacks of stuff. And you're just like, okay, dude. Yeah, it's that's sort of emblematic of the series, right? We care about the artifacts until we don't care about the artifacts.
Yeah. He doesn't work there anymore. And also, apparently most of the department is dead. So,
who's going to protect those anyways? Whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He flees to Tangiers with the help of Sala, who we get John Rhys-Davies in a cameo, basically saying, you know, you got all my family out of Egypt and now they're in New York and he's a cab driver. And this is one of those fan service crowd pleasing sort of like, hey, kind of moments. He's not in the movie for very long. He comes back at the end, but it's all very brief. But it's a little fan servicey, but then we're off to Tangiers where there is there's another chase. We discover, this is what I would say. I didn't hate this scene, but it goes on forever where there's like a tuk-tuk and they're chasing around in the streets and all of that. And it just is very, very long. Also, this is where we meet. Helena has her own short round, basically Teddy, which is, if you think of it that way, it's kind of cute, but they're trying to get this thing. Cause she said that, you know, she wants to sell it to the highest bidder because there's a whole, there's the guys who are buying the thing and Indiana Jones is going to take it and they end up chasing through the streets and there's he has his whip and they all have guns and he has to run and like there's some fun stuff in there, but the tuk-tuk stuff goes on a very long time. And I wanted to use this as an opportunity to also say one thing in a movie that I liked that I can't get my head around is Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character doesn't make a lick of sense. Because she's a mercenary, I only care about this artifact, I was just fooling you, and then at some point, she's not that anymore, and she's just in it for her father's destiny and to do the right thing and help Indiana Jones out. And I mean, maybe I fell asleep briefly during that scene, but I don't believe that her character really makes any sense and that she sort of does whatever she needs to do to serve the plot. So she's a nemesis or an antagonist when she needs to be. And then when she doesn't need to be that anymore, she's not anymore. Either that or she's so overcome by the death of Antonio Banderas, which we haven't gotten to yet, that she decides to go right. But that's a lot of headcanon I'm applying to that.
No, she's still all about the money even after that, because when they're getting away and they're on the boat and they've uncovered the solid gold thing, she's like, yeah, I know who I can sell this to.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. I think I think maybe that we take it as implied that that she turns at some point, maybe after she talks to Indy on the boat at night.
But we don't see it, right?
No, we don't. It's not earned, though. Like, she doesn't have a moment on screen. It's like, maybe I should stop chasing the money and do it was right by my dad and go look for this thing. But we never see that.
Maybe it's just when she discovers holy buttons, time travel's real.
Right.
That's the moment where she's like, okay, I'm in.
No, it was Antonio Banderas all the way.
Except then why is she still all about the money after he's dead?
I'm not explaining it. They don't explain it. Why should I have to?
And that's really my point. Is like I'm willing to go along with it, but after the movie was over, I thought, wait a second.
You know, Jason, when you say that her change of heart isn't motivated, I think part of the problem is why she is such a mercenary in the first place isn't really motivated either.
Right.
I think I think there's this implication that somehow her father ignored her or went crazy, and so she's turning her back on academics or something. But she seems to know her stuff, you know, when she shows up in Indy's classroom.
No, she doesn't turn her back on academics. She's mad at it. So she gets really good at it so that she can use all of his skills to do the one thing that he would never, ever do. That's like textbook rebellion, like literally textbook and then rebellion.
Well, I think if she had been a character who was not the daughter of Jones's friend and colleague, if she'd just shown up in Tangiers as, hi, I'm the person who's trying to sell this now, I wouldn't be so concerned about her motivation, because I would just take it as read like, well, she's got some life that I don't know about. But because we're conditioned to think of her as being this kid that Jones knew back when, you do want to figure out the psychology of this. And the trouble is the psychology of this is all very flimsy to begin with.
I don't know. I bought it 100%. I mean, maybe not the turn at the end, but I was on board with her motivation. The movie was long enough that I was kind of okay without like an extra scene showing us that she like, oh my God, I get it now.
You could have probably shaved off 5 minutes of the tuck-tuck chase, you know?
Actually, yeah, there you go. It wasn't just a tuck-tuck chase. It was a tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck chase.
Yeah, there's lots.
But wasn't the whole point of that was really to set up some, like, her character, too? Because she's having this conversation the whole time. Mm-hmm. It's like, these people are shooting at her with this guy that she jilted, clearly. So I think that's, let's have some exposition about this character while we have a tuck-tuck chase. So,
that's true.
But it was long.
I enjoy Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She's great. The character does a lot of interesting things. I just feel like there's some inconsistency there that I wish that had... Actually, I would have been fine if she helps Indiana all along, but she's also picking up stuff to sell along the way. I would have been fine with that too, right? Where she's like, oh... a Roman helmet. I'm just going to take this, right? Like, that would have worked for me too. But no, she sort of gets with the program and decides to help. We end up in the caves. They go to Sicily. They go to the caves. Oh no. Next we go to the boat. We go to the boat. We meet Antonio Banderas. He is a friend of Indiana Jones, who's a diver, and he's going to help them dive down and get the other part of the goober of the MacGuffin. And fun to see him. I did that. I sort of squinted and turned my eyes, and I was like, "Is that? It is Antonio Banderas."
It took me five shots.
Yeah. Did we know he was going to be in this? Because I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is so fun!"
And he's like a diver who's spent his entire life baking out in the sun, and now he's going to help out. And there's a you know, they go down to the floor to get it, and there's some action stuff in the crashed boat. And I thought this was a more exciting bit of action, and there was a lot of peril there. In the end, the crew on the boat gets killed by the Nazis, and it leads to what I actually, it's one of my favorite moments in the whole movie. I alluded to this earlier, where they are leaving, and because they figured out to go to Sicily, and she makes a crack. I forget exactly what it is, but she makes some sort of a crack about how they're off to do this and how great this is that they're on to the next phase of their adventure. And Indiana Jones says to her, "A man I've known for decades was just murdered and you're making jokes." And I love that moment so much because it's an action movie stopping to say, people die and it's bad, right? People dying is awful. You shouldn't just sweep away to the next adventure, which they then do, right? But it's just, I love that moment. I love that got in the script and that it stayed in the movie, because it's just, she's like the audience. She's like, off to the next one. And he's like, but Antonio Banderas died.
Yeah.
Show some respect.
I think that's really a nice, it's also, again, a nice nod to the aging, because to her, like, you know, she's young. She knows a lot of people. There's a lot of people in her life, that a lot of acquaintances, and, you know, she's moving through life fast and the water is slipping through her hands, where Indiana Jones, he's old. He doesn't have a lot of those people left in his life. So when you lose one, it has a much greater impact on you than when you're younger and like, oh, that's a shame, you know, but I have 47 other diver friends that I can, you know, not that, you know, no, not that he's like thinking like that, but, you know, it doesn't always have the same weight to somebody young who has a much more cavalier attitude about life.
It leads into that nice scene where, you know, he talks about Mary and about leaving, and then, you know, the very subtle revelation that Mutt, Shia LaBeouf, everybody's favorite from Crystal Skull, ended up dying in Vietnam. I love how subtly they did that, because he didn't go through the whole story about how he died and how he signed up. He just says, I would have told my son not to sign up for the Vietnam War or for the war. I don't even think they mentioned Vietnam.
No, just the war.
And it's just left as that. I love how...
And he feels that he did it to spite him, right? That it was like an act of rebellion, which sounds like Mutt to do that.
And with it, you know, Shia LaBeouf's like most emotional contribution to the whole Indiana Jones saga is done off screen by dying in Vietnam. It was actually an affecting scene. Another reason I'm glad I watched Crystal Skull, because if I didn't watch that, I'd still have 2008 me still thinking that I hated Shia LaBeouf in that scene. And I says, oh good, he's dead in Vietnam. But then I watch it again. It says, oh, I feel bad for him now.
It's actually an okay performance.
It is actually. It really was. Yep.
Yeah.
And it provides that context for why there are problems between Marion and Indy. And you're like, okay, I'm starting to feel this now. All right. I'm coming along for the ride emotionally on the romance.
And that stopped swearing in the seats. And she's a little more open-minded now.
Mm-hmm. I did.
So then that leads to the shenanigans in the caves, where we've got, there's a whole little chase in caves. And there's like... It once again, as is classic in Indiana Jones movies, there's things built 2,000 years ago that are like clockwork to this day. Mm-hmm. You press a thing drops, you know, go down a thing. It's full of dirt and water, but it's okay. It works perfectly 2,000 years later. I love it. Yep. And they end up, they handcuff a guy underwater and he dies. That was kind of gruesome.
Short round killed a guy. He did.
Killed a guy. Yeah. Yep. Drowned a guy.
But they also abandon him.
To be fair. Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Yep.
They're just like, Teddy will be fine. Don't worry about him. And they go off.
Well, is she wrong? I feel like that's the story there.
He's not wrong.
He is going to be fine. He's small. He fits through small spaces. It'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And they find Archimedes, burial chamber. And this is the moment where the movie starts to get weird in a, I think, delightful and bizarre way, which is, hey, this artwork has propellers and Archimedes' skeleton is wearing a wristwatch. Mm-hmm. Like, what is happening? And of course, yes, that is the time travel light flashing right there, which is like, well, wait a second, what's going on here? Because this plan is, of course, Vollmer's plan, our Nazi friend, Mads Mikkelsen, is to use the dial to find out when a next time portal, not to create a time portal, just find out when the next time portal opens, because apparently they just open all the time, or at least some of the time. And they're going to go back to 1939, and his plan, I love this, another nice twist, his plan is not to save, you know, Hitler and make sure Hitler wins the war. He believes that Hitler did a bad job, and that if he replaces Hitler, he can win the war, which is that extra level of insanity of your villain that I kind of appreciate, which is like, the problem is Hitler. If I'm Hitler, none of these things happen. I'm like, really? That's your plan? Okay. Okay. That's their plan, is they're going to go fly through a time portal and go back to World War II and kill Hitler and take over. And then they're going to win the war. And so we've got our cave scene, and it leads into the airplane where they, the Jones is a captive on the plane, and Helena stows away in the wheel well. Short round two, Teddy, he hijacks a plane that apparently an Italian pilot is sleeping in the back and doesn't notice, and teaches himself to take off
He's been practicing because remember he had like that weird get up in the restaurant, and I was as soon as they showed a pilot telling him now you got to, you know, ease back on this or whatever. I'm like, okay, this kid's gonna fly a plane
something
this
later,
at some point. At some point, there's gonna be a plane.
I appreciated that the pilot was actually asleep in the back of the plane so he could get up and like be helpful because
I
don't know
that.
It made it a little bit easier for me to swallow the fact that this kid was he's not just flying, you know, under good circumstances. It's really really windy and there's a time portal. I mean, you don't fly through those every day. At
no.
least I don't think most pilots do. So he had help and comic relief at the same time.
It felt almost Miyazaki-like to me, where there's like an old grumpy old man in the back of the plane who's like, ah, oh, kid, you stole my plane. Well, I'll help you fly it. And I'm like, sure, right. Why not? Oh, it's an airplane. So it's fundamentally, it's Miyazaki-like. But that made me think of a Miyazaki sort of move of like, an old man asleep in the back of the plane will help. And then they're flying. And there's a glowy thing in the sky, and they're like, "Aha, the portal! We'll go through it, and we'll land in 1939, and we'll kill Hitler." And I'm sitting there thinking, "Okay, time portal in Indiana Jones. They're really going to do it. They're really going to travel through time in Indiana Jones." I thought, you know what? I like just how wild. Again, talked about our initial conversation. It's Indiana Jones. The wrath of God and some angels turn demons or whatever just melt people like crayons, and there are magic stones that are run by Indian gods, and there's a magic cup that will make you immortal, and there's a knight that's lived for thousands of years, and there's a crystal skull that's made by aliens. Okay, now there's a time portal. Got it. But there's a moment where they're like, you know, you didn't read it right, and I'm sitting there thinking, are we going to really go back to World War II and it's going to wrap around to the beginning of the movie? And then we pass through the time portal and discover they're in 212 BC.
And at the battle he was talking about at the very beginning.
At the very beginning of the movie.
Old part of the movie.
And this is the moment where I just started laughing out loud and saying to myself, you know what? They did it. like they didn't do it a little bit. They were like, you know what? We're going to go all the way. We're going to have like Roman boats and things being fired, and they're going back into the antiquity that Indiana Jones himself studied. And I love that move. I love that that's where they went with it. I would have been disappointed if it was just World War II. And I love that this movie's like, nope, we're going back 2,000 years, baby. That's what we're going to do. It's just bananas.
I like how when you're watching, like we are just like them are kind of like taking that moment to realize, wait a second. That's not World War II.
No.
Look
war.
At those ships. What's happening? And you're like calculating. And I'm like, of course, it's Archimedes. That's so perfect.
Yep. Yeah. And
I thought for a second that they would actually go through it and they would just land where they went and they never travel through time. Mm. I thought there were going to be a way to like sort of like circumvent it all. And then Indy would say, this is just weird. You know, history is alive in all of us or some other like, you know, nonsense like that. And that somehow what's his name? Mads Mikkelsen would actually be the corpse in the tomb.
I did wonder about that.
Wearing the watch. Mm-hmm. Like I was drawing all these conclusions and then I saw some Roman boat. And
yeah.
I guess that's it for my idea.
Yeah.
They are totally going for it. And then I thought, okay, I'm in. Why not? As you said, Nazis were melted like crayons. And
yeah.
So this works.
Time travel. Doctor Who fans don't get to complain about time travel, by the way. Mm-hmm. No, I just, I love how bananas it is. It's like, yes, we went back. And I was reminded of the line, this happens. So they, you know, everybody's fine. And the other plane is there so that although the Nazis die, Indy and Helena bail out, and short round two, he lands with the help of the Italian pilot and pick him up, and they all go home. But before that happens, they see Archimedes. He has a whole conversation about how like he left it for Archimedes is the wisest of all of us, apparently. And he's like, oh no, they're going to come back here, and that's how that works. Okay, Archimedes, great. And Indy says, I'm just going to stay here. And this is that thematic moment. And John, start your engines. This is that thematic moment, which is Indy like, does he have anything to live for? And now he's back in the past. And he's like, well, this is what I've studied and I can see it. And, I was reminded of that line in Raiders of the Lost Ark where Belloc says to him, if we bury you out here, maybe in 2,000 years you would be worth something. And I'm like, oh my God, he's 2,000 years earlier now. We could bury him and his bones will be worth something. But Helena is like, nope. Shut up, old man.
Yep.
And knocks him out and takes him back to the present day, which I just think is it's a very interesting thing of like Indy questioning his desire to go on and to live in the future. And he's always studied the past. So maybe he should just stay back here and nobody's going to miss him. And that's what Helena in this moment just rejects that. And she knows that Marion's there and that she would miss him. And so it's I think it's just a very interesting choice all around to have them go back there and to have him want to stay and to have her refuse to let the hero of the movie decide his own fate. I think it's all really interesting stuff.
Yeah, I had a moment when I really thought that, like, this is it. Like, Indy's not coming back.
Same.
Like, I was not firmly convinced that this was going to have a happy ending.
I thought that would have been a happy ending.
But they set it up because that's a cliche we know from movies all the time, where we as the audience know this is going to be Harrison Ford's last time playing this role. Mm-hmm. So they're playing to that meta expectation of the audience. We've seen 101 films where the hero bows out and decides, oh, I'm leaving now, and you'll take up the mantle of the hero in the next movie or whatever. And I do like the fact that they completely confounded that.
Yeah.
I wanted to say a couple things. One was, my wife Marina is a professor of ancient Greek philosophy, and she was so delighted that they were speaking in ancient Greek, because nobody ever speaks in ancient Greek. And she's on the way out, she's like talking about like, well, you know, people know this about the pronunciation, but the actual ancient Greek is tonal, and so they didn't do the tonal bit. But and I thought, you are the audience of one that scene was written for.
It's you and whoever wrote the ancient Greek that they said. It's those two people.
but yeah, the theming here is funny to me, because I think that ultimately this is a movie about how you have to, you don't get a choice with time. You have to move forward. And we all have to move forward. And even after trauma, after disappointment, after tragedy, we have to move forward. And it's you know, the Nazis are literally trying to move backwards. And I think that there's actually a fairly strong political statement being made here, because it is 2023 and we all know politically what's going on in this country. There are people literally trying to move backwards. And, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to have another Indiana Jones movie to restate that Nazis are not good people. But here we are. The whole film is about sort of Jones wants to stay in the past, and he can't, and he's not given the choice. He comes back and he has to now live in a world where there are astronauts, is basically the way it ends. But that's why it was funny for me that the film starts with such a heavily nostalgic bit of, you know, CGI trickery. It's like, hey, we can go back to the past. We can live in the past. The movie sort of has it both ways, I think.
I guess I would argue that maybe the smash cut to him being so disheveled and sad in 1969 is the movie saying, haha, you don't get that, right? Time has moved on. You can't have that anymore. But they give it to us before they tell us we can't have it. So it's true. It's true.
Well, it makes it hit harder, because we are reminded viscerally of what it felt like to experience the past in those older movies. So that when it comes around, you know, again, you're like, oh yeah, wow. Although I will just say, like, you're right, Jason. Helena definitely did have at some point one of those, you know, come to Indiana moments where she was just like, right, I love this man like a father, so I'm going to make sure he gets back to the place where he belongs. Because I think if she was still the hardened mercenary that she was earlier in the film, she would have just let him stay, which honestly I think would have been fine. They're trying to argue, no, you're going to screw up history. There's already a wristwatch and they have pictures of an airplane. Like maybe he did go back and live there the whole time. Like that could very well be the case. He's not necessarily going to ruin history. So the argument that him staying is a dangerous thing doesn't necessarily hold a heck of a lot of water with
me. He belongs in a museum, Erica.
I was believing that he was going to get to stay in the past. And to me, that would have been a happy ending because that would have been like kind of a fun culmination of his life's journey, like getting to see something that he was so excited about. Like that kind of sounds great. But I also really, really enjoyed the surprise moment where she just cold cocks him out of nowhere and boom, and then he just wakes up.
And to John's theme point, like I think that what the movie is saying there is that Indiana Jones wants to live back in time. I'm sure somebody, whether it was James Mangold or it was one of the other credited screenwriters, the Butterworth brothers, or David Koepp, who also did Crystal Skull, by the way, somebody said, look, Indiana Jones has always been obsessed with the past. Everything he does is about the past. He's an archaeologist. He lectures about the past. He collects objects from the past. And this is his opportunity to go backward in a movie that thematically is about the fact that you can never go back. You can only move forward. As John said, time marches forward and that's all you can do. So in this moment, he is saying, I don't want to go forward. I don't want to live where there are astronauts and moon landings. I'm just going to go back here. And Helena basically says, no, that's not how it works. You got to come and live in the present with everybody else. And you're right, Erica, like, sure, would it have been a fine ending? Yes. But I think thematically, that is what is happening here. Is the movie saying, sorry, Indiana Jones, you don't get to go backward. You too will, you know, grow old and die. And then if you're very lucky, some of your possessions will become, will go in a museum at some point. And that's how it's going to work.
I do like that. I don't know if this was thematically on purpose or anything like that, but you know, we didn't get a lot of direct homages. I'm kind of glad actually that Spielberg didn't direct this, because I feel like he might have been compelled to say, oh, it's the last one, we better throw in, you know, various visual gags to the past films and everything. Like the first time that Indy flies out of New York to Tangier, they just fly there and they get there and the thing, oh wow, they didn't do the map.
There's no
map. But the second time is when they do the map. And it's almost like Indy is back in the saddle now. That first flight, he's still sort of like in a different kind of world. But now he is comfortable with being Indy again. And that's when we get the little map underlay to where it is. And I wonder if that was a thematic reflection of where Indy was thinking, you know what, okay, I'm back in the game here for one more job. And therefore, I get my little map.
Yeah,
montage.
The fan service is pretty limited. At the end, and we've said it before, at the end, we do actually get to see Marion. Karen Allen comes back looking great, I would say. And she is there and he's like, oh, he's still really down. Right. And Helena's like, no, I called her first thing and she's worried about you and she loves you. And, you know, it's I like that moment of like you gave up on yourself, but we didn't give up on you. It's a nice kind of moment. But having her there is a callback. I get it. Having Sala there. And at the end, he gets ice cream with the kids and all of that. But like Sala is a bit of fan service. When he departs, he sings a British Tar, which is right out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So that's fan service. I mean, there's a little bit there. But it's pretty, when we compare it to so many Marvels and Star Treks and Star Warses, it's actually a pretty light touch in that way. And I'm fine with that. But like I like how it ends with, obviously, we get to see Marion. This is the moment where obviously Annette sat forward, maybe sprung up from her seat and
true.
Did a fist pump.
Love it.
Just a little.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was very excited. You know,
like,
though, Marion showing
like
up
clapped.
I think you weren't alone, though. I feel like there are multiple people really excited at that moment. I mean, not just me, but other people around us in the theater. There were a lot of people there. But I think Marion showing up at the end, also the way that she treats him and, when she says, Indy, are you home or are you back? Puts the lie to the way that he had described things earlier. He was an unreliable narrator because he was saying, Mutt died. And then I wasn't able to console Marion, so she drifted away from me. And based on the way that she's saying, hey, are you back?
Yeah.
It tells me mm-hmm. he's the one that actually couldn't handle it. He's the one that sort of drifted away. And I think that, you know, after, like I said, I didn't go back and watch the earlier movies, but I've been listening to all of the Incomparable episodes about them. So, you know, my memory
better.
has been refreshed. And I think that maybe not counting Temple and certainly starting with Last Crusade, all those movies are very much about the sort of emotional character development of Indiana Jones. We get, you know, the relationship between him and his father helping to sort of, you know, break down some of the walls and help him understand the world from the perspective of his dad and not just himself. And then you get the same thing with Mutt. Like, he, you know, he's learning in Crystal Skull, oh, I have a son. I need to, you know, maybe change the way I see the world. And it actually does end with the wedding and the sort of happy almost ending that we get. And it's really lovely. And here it's like he's been put back a little bit and needs to be set back on the right track, and I think at the end has come even further than he was at the end of Crystal Skull. So all in all, I am much happier that he did not get to stay in the past mm-hmm. and be, you know, bros with Archimedes for the rest of his life.
Yeah. This is
much better and right. thematically fits the entire series of Indiana Jones much better.
He would have bled out like in 14 minutes if they left him in ancient Greece.
Probably right.
Yeah. I'm just glad that, you know, this wasn't the second movie where Harrison Ford plays a character who, you know, married someone from the first film and then had a son, and that son, they lost him, and then it drove a wedge between them, and then Harrison Ford character died at the end. I was really scared that that's where this is going to go to.
Dark.
I wept through the entire ending of Force Awakens, let me tell you, because I was a really tragic moment for me.
Mutt went back in time, it turns out, too, and he's angry at Indiana Jones, so he kills him.
He kills him.
Oh, no.
That would be another way to go.
Oh, jeez.
Just don't do that to me again. So no. I was so happy for Phoebe Waller-Bridge's left hook.
Yeah.
Streams are crossing.
For sure. Yeah. Well, it's true. Well, it is interesting that Harrison Ford, after all those years, is like, yeah, sure, I'll play Han Solo again. I'll play Indiana Jones again. I'm like, okay. I guess, you know, maybe he had like a house renovation to do or something.
A new plane to buy or something.
I think,
new runway.
I think Harrison Ford has... As honestly, the parallel here is with the man, the actor who is aging and looking back at his life. And I think coming to terms with the fact that he will be remembered as these characters, these two iconic characters, and being, you know, being more okay with it than maybe he was for a period of time there. That's just my kind of read based on interviews and things like that, that I think maybe there's something there as well, that he was willing to go back here and do this again. So in the end, I think James Mangold did a good job. I think, you know, he's not Steven Spielberg, but I think that he is, he brings a level of gravitas that maybe Steven Spielberg would have been a little bit zanier in ways mm-hmm. that are not necessary. And I think James Mangold did a good job. And it's a fun movie. It's got its issues, but it's got some themes, and it's got some adventure stuff, and then it's got some scenes. I was actually thinking of Erica during the Tuk Tuk thing, because I was thinking Erica, or whenever there's like characters punching other characters and they keep punching each other, and you're like, what are we doing here? I think of Erica because I know that Erica, the thing that everybody likes in movies, and she's like, get it over with. I just want to move on with the rest of my movie. And I was thinking about that a lot. But in general, you know, again, I have positive thoughts. You know, I'm never going to pretend that this is not a movie that exists, right? Like, there's a fifth Indiana Jones movie, and this is it.
I feel seen.
And it was fun. What does everybody else think as we wrap it up?
Nazis and sand make for the best Indiana Jones movies. They've done three of them, and they're all great.
Caves.
I like the other two fine. Caves, too. But, like, whenever they, oh, good, we're going to be, like, somewhere in the Mediterranean, and there's sand everywhere, and the sun has said, yep, this just feels right. Indiana Jones feels right in the desert.
Deb?
I was, you know, honestly, the little bits of fan service were perfect in this. I love the whip and the gun scene, which is certainly a playback to Raiders. Mm-hmm. But I was hoping for like a Short Round update, like justice for Short Round. Not Short Round part two that we had here, but like, Yeah, that was my only disappointment. Like, I was hoping for just a little bit more.
I feel like if they made that movie 2 years later, it absolutely would have happened. But they made this movie before he was in Everything Everywhere All at Once and won an Oscar. Right.
I know. But still, just a mention would have been good.
Right.
That's all I want. That's all I was looking for.
Justice for Short Round. That's fair.
Justice for Short Round.
I'm with you, Deb.
Annette, what do you think? Kate Capshaw.
Final thoughts?
We didn't get a lot of Marion, but I think in those short interactions, I felt like they provided me with a depth of relationship, comfort, knowing each other. That was a mature relationship. And I'm like, okay, so they had their struggles, relationships, marriages, that happens. Now you've come together and I can be back in happy ever after. mode, and she looks fantastic, and I love that her outfit was a little ode to the first movie, and that made me really happy. So I left the movie theater feeling really good.
Nice. Erica?
I mean, I really did love it. Sorry to end on a down note, but I just realized I didn't have a chance to mention. We talked a little bit, Annette and I, about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's costumes, which were just all amazing, and I want all of them. But also, the character Mason, played by Shonat Renee Wilson, who was the CIA agent, who was like, you're like, is she good? Is she bad? She was just awesome, and I loved that character. But I think the hardest moment to watch of the movie for me was watching a Nazi shoot a black woman. I was like, ooh, this is really 2023, but in all the bad ways, as well as all of the good ways. So that was a little bit harsher than I kind of wanted in my escapism movie. But it was a long enough film that I guess after that happened, there was still a lot of stuff happening. So by the end, I was able to see that credit that said, you know, Phoebe Waller-Bridge's outfit. Upcycled Fabrics by Stella McCartney, and I was like, wow, and it had its own like place on the screen. That was a very cool credit. And I laughed.
McCartney at the beginning of the movie, McCartney at the
end.
That's
true. Bookended by McCartney's.
Did anybody just like sit there and listen to that John Williams score to the very end?
Absolutely.
This ended on a bit of a down note too. It never like picked up into a big finale or anything. Like just sort of like kind of faded out, kind of like Indy's life itself. I was expecting a big rousing fanfare of the da 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 da, but never got there.
No, it's true.
It just quietly ended.
Yeah, it is the last probably score by John Williams, and he. One of the things that's fun about it is that when we get to sad Indy, we don't get any of the rousing themes until he's back in the saddle in Africa, maybe in the Mediterranean. Like it comes back, but like it's not there when he's sad. Like the music gets to be, John Williams said that he made it more like his 60s scores. When they're in that part, and then it becomes Indiana Jones again later. It's that guy.
Guy.
If only more people appreciated John Williams. Oh, wait a second. If you appreciate John Williams, it's fine. It's fine. John, you have any final thoughts?
Just that this was actually the first film I saw. Me and my wife went out to a movie theater to see a movie since the pandemic. And it was a really good film to see after not being in a movie theater for 3 years.
Good. That's excellent. All right. I think that brings us to the end of... We've covered all available Indiana Jones films now, everybody.
Annette wants you to now do the show.
Nope, not going
to
happen.
Okay, so one of the members sent me a link to the show on YouTube. It's just freely available on YouTube. I have to say, this old indie... better than that old indie. It's very funny to me to watch now that, you know, we have a proper old indie.
The guy with the eye patch.
And the show is very mediocre, but I am still kind of enjoying it. So thank you to that member.
And thanks to everybody out there for listening to us catch up on Indiana Jones movies. We've run out, so we'll be back next time with something that is not Indiana Jones, we promise. But until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.